The National Geographic Society today announces the results of an expedition to the Solomon Islands in the Western Pacific. It was to look for one of the most famous sunken craft of World War II, PT-109. That was the Navy patrol boat skippered by the dashing young Jack Kennedy years before he became President Kennedy. For the latest National Geographic radio expedition, NPR's Neil Conan joined undersea explorer Robert Ballard on the search for PT-109.
It happened 59 years ago on a moonless night, just like this one. We're in Blackett Strait, an obscure passage amidst a maze of islands and reefs. At this stage of the war, in August 1943, Japanese destroyers raced through here with supplies for their troops. Americans called it the Tokyo Express. That night, American PT boats lay in wait. What happened was dramatic and heroic and controversial, but those were not uncommon qualities in the Solomon Islands in those days. We remember this night because the captain of one PT boat would later become President of the United States. John F. Kennedy's boat and an important part of his story are here in Blackett Strait, and Robert Ballard is determined to find them. The search is based aboard the Grey Scout, ship usually occupied as a fishing charter further south near Australia. Ballard has converted the main cabin into a computer lab. And between all of the equipment in here and the blazing heat outside, it's sweltering.
So, we're in the groove. Great weather. Small bucket of water, but it's also a very small target. Particularly if the wood's gone. It's a very small target.
Jack Kennedy's PT boat was less than 90 feet long to begin with. It was torn to pieces in a collision with a Japanese destroyer, and there's every chance that worms have eaten away most of the mahogany and plywood it was made of. But even so, some parts would still be here on the bottom. The machine guns, the engines, and the torpedo tubes. Metal parts that should ring loud and clear on sonar.
It should be a very hard target, and it should show up unless we're in a very rugged, mountainous area, and parts of the search area are volcanic. So that means it's going to be hard to pick out one hard thing sitting on a hard thing. So we'd love it to be right where we are right now, where there's a very, very gentle, muddy bottom, and a wreckage of the PT boat would stand out. So we're just hoping that we get lucky.
The Grey Scout is towing a side-scan sonar about 150 feet off the bottom. It bounces sound waves off the rocks and coral and mud and paints an electronic picture of the bottom. It's a tedious business, but using naval records, Ballard has narrowed the search to a 35-square-mile box. It's hypnotic to watch the blurry sonar squiggles as they scroll up on the computer screen, expecting history to pop up any minute. Dwight Coleman, Ballard's principal assistant, keeps a record of anything unusual.
What you got there?
Not sure. It's a very hard object. It certainly looks man-made, non-natural. It's sitting out all by itself, not amongst any other geological features that it might be part of. So I would say it's definitely a man-made item. It's about 9 meters by 6 meters in size. So according to our expert here, it may be a Japanese landing barge, something like that.
That'd be close to what you would say for a small Japanese landing barge.
This is military historian and weapons expert Dale Ritter. He's come along to identify whatever's found on the bottom.
I have to start digging out my reference stuff and checking on it.
It could also be PT-109, or a part of it. Most history books say the boat was cut in half by the collision, and that's the way they played it in the movie PT-109, a worshipful version of the story that was made in 1961. While John Kennedy was in the White House.
Ship at 2 o'clock!
The speeding destroyer was hidden by the black shadow of the island behind, Kolombangara, and most accounts agree that Kennedy and his crew had 15 seconds to react, maybe less.
Hey!
In his own account, John Kennedy said he looked up and saw the hull of the destroyer passing by to his right like a wall. To Dale Ritter, that doesn't suggest that the boat was cut in half, but that the destroyer sliced off a chunk of the starboard side. If it happened that way, the slice would have gone straight down to the bottom. Two members of the crew were never seen again after the crash, and historian Richard Frank says the others only survived by a fluke.
They were fantastically lucky that the 100-octane gasoline tanks
didn't ignite in a fireball and incinerate all of them. There was a fire. There was injury to at least two members of the crew from fire. People swallowed gasoline or the fumes. It was overpowering. You're talking a second or two, a foot or two difference between Kennedy being killed and Kennedy surviving. It was just a tremendously traumatic event.
Over the years, there would be questions asked about John Kennedy's conduct before the collision. Were he and his crew as alert as they should have been? Why didn't they see the destroyer until the last second? Why was he running on just one engine? But there are no questions about what happened afterwards. Kennedy and his executive officer, Lenny Tom, gathered their crew on the bow of the wreck and drifted for the rest of the night. They couldn't stay after sunup. Japanese troops were just a mile away on Kolombangara. American airplanes would be in the air, but they were notorious for shooting anything afloat. And the boat was sinking anyway. The crew lashed together a makeshift raft, and Kennedy himself took charge of the most seriously injured man, a sailor named Pops McMahon. He took a strap from McMahon's life jacket between his teeth and started to swim. Exactly how far and how long it took, nobody knows for sure, but miles and hours. It must have seemed like forever. This is where they came ashore. On the sailing charts, it was called Plum Pudding Island, but Kennedy didn't know that name. He called it Bird Island. It's since become known as Kennedy Island. This is a tiny little spit of sand populated by those birds and a lot of hard-working hermit crabs. I walked around with Admiral Jay Cohen, the director of the Office of Naval Research.
When you look at the scale here and you realize the tremendous feat it was, what great physical condition John Kennedy and the rest of his crew must have been in. You know, we're standing here in the shade of a tree and you can hear the waves very quietly lapping, but, you know, it's probably 100% humidity and about 110 in the sun. You can imagine swimming this, especially having to stay out of the water and try and be on land, certainly in the daylight, so that you wouldn't get captured. It really is timeless, and it's very moving.
John F. Kennedy was a very junior, very green PT boat skipper who had never had a close encounter.
Historian Richard Frank.
But he's about average under the circumstances, and I think that's how he was judged by his peers. And his conduct afterwards, I think the finest testimonial to that was the way his crew regarded him. They revered him for his conduct, and they were the judges who were best placed to assess what he was really like.
Back on the Gray Scout, Robert Ballard's crew winches the Dayglow yellow sonar up out of the water. The electronic picture it's painted of the bottom shows a lot of targets that are more or less the right size. Dozens and dozens of PT boat-sized targets. Ballard has to decide whether to look for the stern, and from naval records, he's pretty sure it's down amidst a hopeless clutter of rocks and coral, or bet on the slice theory and go looking for the bow. For Radio Expeditions, this is Neil Conan reporting from the Solomon Islands.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, the outcome of the search for PT-109. Radio Expeditions is a co-production of NPR News and the National Geographic.